Hi everybody, welcome back. It's May 24th and we're in part 4 of Echo and this is chapter 2. As the taxi pulled up to the corner of 57th Street and 7th Avenue in New York City, Mike Flannery rushed from the lobby of the theater where he'd been waiting and pacing in his tuxedo. The back door opened and Frankie jumped out, running to Mike and hugging him. "Look at you! Carnegie Hall, just like we said. Are the balconies all gold and the seats all red?" Mike laughed and patted Frankie on the back. "It's as if you're standing inside an ornate golden egg. And yes, the seats are just like Granny said they'd be." He held Frankie at arm's length, admiring his suit. "You don't look so bad yourself. Your first year of law school is agreeing with you." "Top of the class so far," he said, standing taller. "Guess what? We're going to eat roasted beef and ice cream after, for old time's sake. Or for new time's sake. Someone made reservations at the Russian Tea Room." Frankie nodded toward the taxi, grinning. Mr. Howard helped Aunt Uni from the back seat. She looked elegant in her long black dress and gray fox stole. "I made the reservations," she said, pulling Mike into a hug. "Thank you, Auntie," said Mike, kissing her on the cheek. It had become his endearment for her, and she insisted it suited her far better than the much too formal Aunt Uni. "Mr. and Mrs. Potter send you their best," she said. "How are they?" asked Mike. "Happy as clams in Atlantic City with their daughter and grandchildren. As much as I miss them, retirement is agreeing with them." After Mr. Howard paid for the taxi, he embraced Mike too.
"We're so proud of you, Mike. How have the rehearsals gone?"
"They've gone well, I think. I like the conductor, Friedrich Schmidt, very much. By the way, he is looking for a lawyer to help him finalize some paperwork for his father and uncle. I overheard him talking in the green room, and I recommended your firm. He's interested in speaking with you. I can introduce you backstage after the concert."
"It will be my pleasure, and I'll offer him assistance pro bono."
Frankie leaned in. "That means without charge for the public good." Mike rolled his eyes. "I know." He looked at Mr. Howard. "Is he becoming insufferable?"
"Only on occasion."
He put his arms around Mike and Frankie, pulling them close.
"Oh, it's so good to have all of us together again."
Mike led them inside and handed them off to an usher. "I have to go now." He winked at Auntie. "I'm looking forward to the roasted beef and ice cream." "And cake," she said, smiling. He kissed her cheek again.
"Auntie, I'd never be here without you."
She straightened the lapel of his jacket. "We helped each other, didn't we? But I think I received the best part of our arrangement. Two fine boys." Mike blinked back tears. Granny had known it in her soul. The right person had found them. Frankie leaned toward Mike and held out an upright fist.
"You and me, we stick together."
Mike did the same, tapping Frankie's. "That's right, kid. You and me." In his dressing room, Mike waited for his call. It was funny how Frankie's words could rekindle his childhood memories. Granny telling them all about Carnegie Hall, the cellar at Bishop's, and the night he and Frankie tried to run away. It turned out that all those years ago, he'd been wrong about Auntie. She had wanted them. Mike had been mistaken about the papers he'd seen on her desk. The appeal for the reversal of their adoptions had been approved and the papers sent to her, but they wouldn't become legal unless she signed them, which she never intended to do. When Mike had confronted her that day in the library, his love for Frankie had shined a light on her heart. She ceremoniously burned the papers in the fireplace the day after Mike's fall from the tree, when by some grace, nothing more than the wind was knocked out of him. Mike, Frankie, Mr. and Mrs. Potter, Auntie and Mr. Howard, they never called him anything other than Mr. Howard, even after he and Auntie married, moved to his house on the corner. The best, not the worst, had happened to him and Frankie. Mike was invited to join Hoxie's band, and he did, for 1 year. Mr. Potter had been overjoyed and continued to be his coach. Then, as the piano consumed Mike's interest and time, he began to think about leaving the band.
One day, a representative from the Women's Auxiliary gave an impassioned plea for old instruments that could be sent to poor children who might otherwise never have a chance at music. Mike felt strangely compelled, as if he should pass his harmonica along, as if someone were waiting for it. So he gave it up, sending it on a journey to another child who needed the world to seem brighter with more possibilities and wanted to testify to feelings in his or her heart, just as Mike had. By the time Frankie was old enough to join, the famous Philadelphia Harmonica Band of Wizards had dissolved due to lack of funds. Frankie didn't mind because by then he hoped to be a cowboy and was saving Ralston Purina cereal box tops for a series of Tom Mix comic books. After high school, Mike was admitted to Juilliard School of Music in New York City. Before he could enter, the U.S. government lowered the draft age to 18. America was at war, and Mike entered the U.S. Army. After his tour of duty, he finally went to Juilliard and then auditioned for the Philadelphia Philharmonic. A few years later, he moved to New York City, the place he always dreamed he would belong. There was a knock on the private dressing room door. A voice from the other side said, "Mr. Flannery, 5 minutes, sir." "Thank you," called Mike, taking a deep breath. He headed toward the stage, catching the eye of the stage manager, who waved him over to the wing. "About 3 minutes until your solo." Mike heard the last lines of the Porgy and Bess suite and the thunderous applause that followed. Friedrich Schmidt walked off the stage to the wing where Mike stood waiting. "Ready?" he asked, smiling. Mike nodded. "Ready." Friedrich waited until the orchestra had regrouped and turned the pages of their music before walking back on stage. Mike followed and sat at the piano. Friedrich raised his baton. Mike heard the clarinet glissando that opened Rhapsody in Blue. He waited for the horns and strings and the rest of the orchestra to fan out around him. He stretched his fingers and held them over the keys, as he had once done in Granny's parlor and in the music room on Amaryllis Drive, feeling the all-too-familiar attraction to play and perform. He waited for the crescendo and began. While he played, he thought about how Gershwin had composed much of the piece on a train, with the rattling and jiggling and clacking over the rails. Gershwin heard music in the midst of noise and saw the piece as an array of all that was American, a composition of people of every color, rich and poor, quiet and loud, a mishmash of humanity. Mike played it as if he were in Granny's neighborhood, with girls playing hopscotch and boys playing pimple ball and cars and trucks honking and mothers hollering out their windows for their children. At the tender interval before the finale, he heard his mother humming and saw Granny throwing open the window so the entire neighborhood could hear the beauty of his playing. The music sauntered through Central Park, strolled through boroughs, tiptoed across bridges, waltzed in ballrooms, ran. The Big Apple, his city, the place he'd always wanted to be, the place Granny had loved and always wanted to take him. Was he really here on this stage? He pounded out the rhythms of sledgehammers and the staccato riveters as the city grew upward, scraping the sky. He followed the music, but his heart was following his journey to this very spot in time. From Allentown to Philly to Bishop's, and his and Frankie's promises to stick together. From Bishop's to Amaryllis Drive, and learning to hope for the best, and that no matter how much sadness there is in life, there are equal amounts of maybe things will get better someday soon. From Hoxie's Philadelphia Harmonica Band to the U.S. Army to Juilliard to this piano bench in Carnegie Hall, where, for one moment, with any luck, the audience's heart and the world would stand still. The conductor wrapped the orchestra around him, and together they brought the audience to their feet. Mike slid from the piano bench, took a breath, and bowed as the applause embraced him. Above all the cheers, he heard Frankie calling out, "Bravo! Bravo!"